Welcome to New Mexico in Focus, the podcast for Monday, September 11th, 2023. I'm Lou DeVizio. There's a lot going on around New Mexico as we start the week. The governor's emergency declaration over gun violence and the search for whoever fired more than a dozen shots into a vehicle outside Isotopes Park, killing an 11-year-old boy. I'll have updates on both of those stories in less than a minute, along with an announcement from Albuquerque Fire Rescue on last month's plastics fire. But I want to let you guys know what we have for you for the rest of the show, too. In about 5 minutes, New Mexico in Focus correspondent Russell Contreras sits down with a special panel to remember the career and legacy of Governor Bill Richardson. Richardson died in his sleep on September 1st at the age of 75. You'll hear from a retired reporter who started covering Richardson in the early 1980s and right on through his two terms as governor. Russell also speaks with a former advisor who consulted with Richardson on women's issues. And finally, Richardson's second in command during his time in the governor's mansion, former Lieutenant Governor Diane Denish. After that, in a little over 30 minutes, I chat with the leader of a nonprofit home builder in Santa Fe about a new so-called mansion tax voters in the city will consider this November. But for now, let's get into the headlines. Police in Albuquerque are searching for whoever shot and killed an 11-year-old in what authorities are calling a road rage incident while leaving an Isotopes game last week. Investigators say someone fired 17 shots at a truck leaving the game on the evening of September 6th, killing Froylan Villegas and critically injuring his aunt, who is still in the hospital as of this recording. Villegas' mother and infant brother were both in the back seat but were not hit. Albuquerque police have released a photo of a newer model black Dodge Durango, believed to be the SUV the suspect or suspects were driving in. Police are trying to identify whoever fired the shots. No arrests have been made to this point. Local law enforcement in Bernalillo County will not uphold Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham's temporary ban on carrying firearms on public property, an order the governor issued in part in response to last week's shooting. State police, however, have been assigned to enforce the measure by issuing civil citations carrying a fine of up to $5,000. As for Albuquerque police, Chief Harold Medina said his department has not committed to enforcing the ban because it could violate the department's police reform settlement agreement with the U.S. Department of Justice. Bernalillo County Sheriff John Allen has said he won't order his deputies to enforce it because of concerns over potential Second Amendment violations. The governor issued the ban as a public health order, prohibiting open and concealed carry in most public places for the next 30 days. More than 100 people turned up in Albuquerque's Old Town Plaza over the weekend, armed with a wide assortment of guns, all to protest the ban. No citations were issued, though the governor's spokesperson says fines will be forthcoming. Fire investigators say they can't determine the cause of last month's Albuquerque plastics fire. Albuquerque Fire Rescue had initially said investigators found the cause to be accidental, but this week, the department issued a release saying they don't have any physical evidence. That's besides discovering the fire originated in a smoking area outside the facility. That means investigators can't meet the unusually high standard of beyond a reasonable doubt, as detailed in a release from the department. Whatever started it, we know the fire released hazardous pollutants into the air. The company, ATCOR, is responsible for cleanup and any health impacts to the public or first responders. Now to that special roundtable remembering Bill Richardson. We begin with New Mexico in Focus correspondent Russell Contreras looking back at Richardson's time in the governor's mansion between 2003 and 2010, a period when he served as the nation's only Hispanic governor. Joining Russell at the table are Martha Burke, a former advisor to the Richardson administration, an author, and the host of the podcast Equal Time with Martha Burke. Then there's Steve Terrell, a retired reporter from the Santa Fe, New Mexican, who covered Richardson for decades. And finally, Diane Denish, who served 8 years as lieutenant governor in the Richardson administration. Here's Russell.
Thanks, Lou. I'm New Mexico in Focus correspondent Russell Contreras, here to put as much as Bill Richardson's legacy into context as I can in this limited space of time. Joining me today at the table is Martha Burke. She's the author and host of the podcast Equal Time with Martha Burke. Across the table is Steve Terrell, retired reporter with the Santa Fe, New Mexican. And finally, of course, it's the wonderful Diane Denish, who served 8 years as lieutenant governor under Bill Richardson. It's great to see you all back. We begin today's show looking back at the life and political career of former New Mexico Governor Bill Richardson, who died in his sleep this past weekend at the age of 75. Richardson left a deep footprint in the politics, not just here in New Mexico, but other places. He spent 14 years representing our state in Congress before becoming a UN ambassador, an energy secretary, and finally two terms of governor. It would be impossible to recount every statement praising his life and career, but one that stands out came from New Mexico Congressman Gabe Vasquez, who called Richardson, quote, one of the most powerful Hispanics in politics that this nation has seen. We'll get into his long list of accomplishments and some of the scandals that followed him, but I want to ask all of you, all as New Mexicans, looking back at his legacy, how did Richardson stand out as a lawmaker, as a member of the House in the 1990s, and as governor between 2003 and 2011? I'll start with you, Diane. You work with him closely. What do you remember about him as a governor and as a politician trying to make New Mexico a better place?
You know, I thought he took a lot of risk of things he wanted to do. He brought hope and optimism through some of his initiatives to New Mexico. He improved the lives of women in New Mexico, but he improved in health care. He took some initiatives way before Obamacare to ensure kids on their policies until they were 26. We passed the pregnancy premium assistant program, things that later became part of Obamacare. So he was ahead of his time on some of his initiatives. And for me, the spaceport, nothing says that like the spaceport. That was, he brought such a vision of what it could be in the future and actually what it's going to become over time. Mm-hmm. Takes a long time for these initiatives. He did promise us we would maybe have a launch in 2 years after we first announced it. It took a little longer than that. But meanwhile, it was been a wonderful educational opportunity for kids from that part of the state or from kids all over New Mexico and for scientists. So taking those risks, he wanted them to pay off, and he worked hard to get those things done. He knew how to negotiate with the legislature. He knew how to, for instance, take the food tax off with one vote margin in the House. He was just he really was very intuitive about not only his own, how to forward his own interest, but what were their interest in doing these big things.
You mentioned the spaceport, but he also had the Rail Runner. There was also, you know, his abolishing the death penalty, establishing a foundation for the film industry, and creating the nation's first pay equity initiative. It goes on and on. What do you remember about that, the Rail Runner? And that one's like was so groundbreaking at the time. We kind of laugh at it now. Yeah. But we didn't have this. What do you remember about that?
Well, what I remember is there were, of course, a lot of negotiations with the railroad companies to try to get it. He always wanted it to go all the way to Las Cruces, and so that people could travel across the state. But what I remember about it was that he had a woman in the State Transportation Department, Rhonda Fott, and I remember there were many negotiations with highway people, and so he didn't have to just get it done in the legislature. He had to get it done through the administrative processes too, and all the right-of-ways and the things that happened. And you know, the film industry, I wanted to say, you know, that had been languishing since 1968 when Dave Cargo was governor. Sure. That was the first film commission. And Bill had been, you know, percolating about that for a long time. And then he hired really good people around him that knew the subject matter. I think that's one of the keys for Bill Richardson was he wasn't afraid of star power or people who knew more than he did. And as one of the deputy UN ambassador, Nancy Soldeberg told me, he knew what he didn't know.
Steve, a lot of people have great ideas, previous governors, but it was Richardson's style that was able to get things done. What can you tell us about a style to get stuff like the Rail Runner fixed, and also reforming the Department of Education?
His style, a lot of people criticized him for being like a rumpled. He was an everyman in his appearance. Big guy, heavy set. I think it was a combination of sweet talk and arm twisting. He worked behind the scenes. He wasn't afraid to twist arms, but he tried to work with people. He tried to work with Republicans, and successfully often. And so his style, it was bipartisan in a lot of ways, but you always knew who he was, the boss. So that's what I remember about him, and I think that's why he was successful in so many things.
Martha, you were an unofficial cabinet member under Richardson with a fancy title, Senior Policy Advisor for Women's Issues. He was a kind of a nest of paradoxes. He was pro-business, he was pro-choice Catholic who cut taxes, he believed in public works. How do you navigate these contradictions when pushing these issues that you thought deserved attention? And you have to remember, he was also a Clinton cabinet member who came from that ethos, and we had some criticism on how he viewed women. How did you negotiate that?
Well, it was, shall we say, a very formal relationship I had with him. We were colleagues, we worked together. Well, I was first hired by him for the campaign, the presidential campaign, which, as we know, did not last very long. But we went to New Hampshire and Iowa, and he wanted, because I had just come from Washington, and I had a lot of national press experience, and I also knew in depth what went on in Capitol Hill, what bills were there, all of that. Because I had a fairly, presence in the media when I was there, I think he knew all of that, and he thought he could benefit from my knowledge, and I hope he did. He certainly listened to what I told him in terms of what I thought was important for the presidential debates, and then we will get in later to what I did for him after he dropped out of that. But I found him to be extremely receptive to me and to the ideas. He hired me to educate him further on. It wasn't that he didn't know about what needed to be done, but he wanted more detail. He was always, he wanted to know sort of what was under the radar on things because he didn't like to be surprised.
As we all know, Richardson's second term was in some ways derailed by a series of scandals. Federal grand jury investigations into alleged pay-to-play and campaign finance violations. No charges were ever came, but the controversies were enough to close the door on a potential cabinet seat in the Obama administrations. How did those battles shape the way New Mexicans thought about Bill Richardson then and now? Because you remember this, future President Obama was calling him all the time, so was Hillary Clinton, saying, what do you need? And then all of a sudden he was gone. He was off the stage. What happened?
Yeah, after he took himself out of consideration for the cabinet, he became political poison. I think Diane knows this more than any of us. I think that cost you your governor's race back in 2010. I would almost call that his exile period. He still, after he left the governor's office, he started the Richardson Center for, what's the formal name for, but it's basically helping hostages internationally. And he kept that up, nobody was asking for Richardson's endorsement or anything when they're running for office after these scandals, especially after the cabinet position went kaplooey.
Lieutenant Governor, I always thought this, that you were running for this seat, you were trying to follow Governor Richardson, advocating for some of the policies. But did you feel that when Susana Martinez was running against you, she kept throwing his name? She very seldom said your name because then she would have to debate the issues, which polls show they backed you. Do you feel that hurt you in your race? And could he have done anything to help you?
Well, we had many conversations during my race, and his advice to me was to stay away from him because he was a political realist, and he knew that associating myself. But I tried not to run away from things that I thought were successful things we did during the campaign. But he was a very good advisor to me during that time and was very careful not to promote me because that would be used against me. So, at the end of the day, we had a lot of fun and some sad moments when he pulled his name out. I was in Washington when that happened. And he called me at the, I was shopping for some shoes to go to a, a conference with Democratic governors. And he said, it's a bad day for me. And I think he felt really bad about that. But I do think that when you ask the question about how did it form people's opinion, in the short term, I think that, you know, it affected him very negatively. In the long term, I think Bill Richardson will have a huge legacy of impact on New Mexico and how he really affected people's lives and changed some people's lives.
Martha, with all the ups and downs, briefly, what's the balance in Richard's legacy? How do we look at it now?
Well, of course, I look at it through a gender lens, and he did a really progressive work in terms of pay equity for women. He didn't mind taking advice. If he didn't know something, he, as I said, he would ask, and he wanted to understand it in depth. But then he would pretty much, he knew the professionals knew what they were doing for the most part. He would stay hands off, but he always wanted to be in the loop. And I think that was one of his strengths. He knew where to go for the stuff that he needed to know more about. And he wasn't ashamed to say, I need to know more about this so I can be more effective in getting it done.
Looking broadly past his work as governor, Richardson went from being derided in the 1980s as a carpetbagger with roots in Mexico and California to becoming the face of politics in New Mexico. Here is a fluent Spanish speaker, a high-profile Hispanic politician at a time when there weren't nearly as many as there are now. But how did Richardson's time in the national spotlight, whether as governor or United Nations ambassador or energy secretary, shape the way people outside of our state think of New Mexico? I'll start with you, Diane. You talked about seeing him grumpled when he was running for office as a congressman in the 1980s there in northern New Mexico to becoming somebody on the national stage. And it was relatively unique because he was not from here. And as we said, we privileged the people that liked the Esequias and played basketball. How did he able to accomplish this?
Well, you know, I think you just glossed over the fact that he spoke Spanish. I think when I saw him in northern New Mexico and southern New Mexico in little pocket communities, Bill Richardson always, you know, he knew when he could speak Spanish. And frankly, a lot of people weren't so aware of his background. They didn't pay much attention to the carpetbagger, the political words that were used many times in the arena. But having spoken to many people this week since his death, everybody has a story about Bill Richardson. And that tells you something about the kind of retail political guy he was. One person told me that, you know, after Bill Richardson came to New Mexico and after he was governor, the weatherman quit standing in front of New Mexico on the map, and they always moved over, and New Mexico was on the map. And I thought that was a really cute interpretation of his influence on putting us on the map. So I think he did. And, you know, when I was first lieutenant governor, he brought the North Koreans, and he invited me to dinner with them, to their surprise and certainly to my surprise. And, you know, he had a really broad open door, and he would bring not just expert policy people around him, but, you know, the fourth floor just really lit up a lot with movie stars like Shirley MacLaine and Gene Hackman and Sean Penn and all these people that came up. And Redford, Sean Penn and Redford had different agendas, the environment, world peace. But, you know, he never shut any policy discussions out, even if they weren't locally based.
And on that note, Steve, what about here at home? I mean, he was different from anybody who preceded him or succeeded him here as governor. He was ambitious from the start. When he ran for president, he had a huge personality, a governor style, and it affected the way New Mexicans thought about him. What kind of politician did he become? Was it transforming? Was it evolving? What did you see in covering him?
Well, actually, I think even though their styles were different, I see a lot of Bruce King in Richardson. Mm-hmm. A big guy who goes in the room, knows everybody. How's your mom? How's your brother? You know.
He might not elect that if you told him that to his face.
Yeah, he might not. He might argue with me on that. But it's true, Bill. You're talking about the carpetbagger stuff. I think he shook that fairly early in his career. He had so many town halls throughout northern New Mexico when he was in Congress. And I covered a few of those. I didn't really cover Congress a lot back then, but every one time I went, he knew people, and not just the big wigs, not just the political leaders. He knew farmers and ranchers and workers. He seemed to take a personal interest in them, and he listened to them. And I think that's how he came off. He was a transformational politician. He got a lot of stuff done that no one would dream of. And we talk about the Rail Runner and the spaceport. Those are big accomplishments. But I think even bigger was his the film industry, like we discussed a little bit earlier. I think that had more lasting impact than the spaceport or any of them.
And Martha, how was he viewed nationally?
I beg your pardon?
How was he viewed nationally?
Well, he was viewed positively for the most part. He had his detractors, of course, and politics then, it's hard to imagine because they're so bitter now, but people were still polite to one another for the most part. And so even if they didn't agree with him, they respected what he could do and had done, and his potential, I think, as well. So I think in that department, he was pretty solidly entrenched with not only the constituents, but with the colleagues. He'd been in Congress, obviously. He had all of those contacts, and I think he was still very well regarded.
And yet there were also plenty of contradictions to Bill Richardson. He was a champion for women's issues. We talked about the pay equity thing that he was able to get through. Yet his name turned up in connection with Jeffrey Epstein. He sprung journalists out of foreign prisons, and yet he could be elusive and thorny with the local press. How do we negotiate that?
Carefully. But I think most of the members of the press knew his ups and downs, would you say, or quirks, how to sort of relate to him. That was true in my role as well. It was strictly professional. We were not colleagues outside of the work. We were not personal friends, although we were always cordial. And I think you just had to realize his the depth he had and the different kinds of ways you might have to interact with him depending on the subject, depending on the time. He was very time sensitive. He wanted you to get to the point. And it just took a little bit of thinking carefully before you ever got with him. What is your goal here? How can you accomplish it? Knowing his depth of knowledge, which was considerable on many things, and knowing his personal style.
And still pay equity. You still think that's a great accomplishment?
I know it is. It was a first in the nation initiative, and I have to say it was so disappointing, and I know Diane would share this, that a woman governor that followed him killed it. It was the first initiative in the nation, first of all, to study our own pay equity in the state workforce, and it was quite a good report. We were doing very well. But this was to have any contractor that wanted a contract with the state of New Mexico to tell us how they were paying women and how they were paying men. Because that's taxpayer money, and we had a right to know. Not anybody's salary on a bulletin board, just aggregate data. And it was a model effort, and as I said, first in the nation, and it had the potential for national replication. And when Martinez came in, it all went away.
And Diane, he helped negotiate the release of Americans held in captive in places like North Korea, Sudan, Iraq, Cuba. And just last year, he played a part in bringing U.S. Women's basketball player Brittany Griner back from detention in Moscow. He liked the term freelance negotiator, and he had some real successes in spots where the government had failed. How did his personality lend itself to that work? And where does his death leave the void in this corner of international relations? We don't have a governor who have these skills like there. What do we lose?
Well, I think what we lost was somebody who had the true interest of the families, A lot of times, and I think that's where Bill became a rogue or a freelance negotiator, was he wanted to help those families be reunited. That was his strength. The Pentagon, other negotiators, they have other interests at heart, how the president looks, those kind of things. I'll tell you a cute story. I saw him at something when the Brittany Griner first happened. And I said, are you going to get Brittany Griner out? And he said, well, I've got a little competition for that. And I said, who would that be? And he said, Joe Biden. And he said, you know, he wants the credit. And I said, I'm going to tell you the lesson I learned under you. He's the president. You do the work, he gets the credit. That's how it goes. And we laughed about that. And he said, is that true? And I said, that's right. I said, you'll get your share of the credit, Governor. Just do the best you can to bring her home.
Let's go around the table one more time. If Richardson were sitting here, Steve, right now, what would he say he was most proud of during his time in public office, if you could get him to be honest?
Well, I think he'd probably have about 35 items that he would list.
And get mad if he didn't have the time to mention them all. Right?
Yeah. And so I think he just lists all the things we've talked about, and probably more than we hadn't even thought of.
Mm-hmm. Martha, what do you think he would be proud of?
I think he'd be proud of the gender parity in his administration. One of the first things he looked at after I went to work with him was how are women and men being paid in this administration? And he always had an eye on gender equity. He had so many other things going on that I don't know that it was at the top of the list, but it was always in that list. Mm.
Diane, there were many things. Reforming Department of Ed?
Department of Ed, but I think one of the things that I have to mention is when I became Lieutenant Governor and I wanted to work on early childhood, he gave me the resources and the staff and the expertise around me to make sure that we could do everything possible for kids 0 to 5. And even after he kept pushing me to say, you should get more credit for that. You should get more credit for that. And I said, Governor, I never could have done it without you. So I want to say not just pay equity, but hiring women and supporting them and helping them be successful would be one of his accomplishments. I happen to think the film industry is probably, when he talks about his policy initiatives, I think it created so many jobs. It's had so much longevity. I think he would really focus on that as being something he did for New Mexico to diversify our economy.
You know, when he released his memoir, he told me, I asked him, did he have any regrets? And he told me, yes, I do. I should have told my father I loved him. Mm-hmm. And he said, I never had that chance.
I would like to second what you said about being given the resources to do what needed to be done. You didn't have to go beg. You didn't have to say, I need more money. I need more staff. He would say, what do you need?
No.
At the end of in the second administration, over 50% of the cabinet secretaries were women in Bill Richards' administration, and they all knew what they were doing, and he didn't treat them any differently than he did the men. If they messed up, as we know from the current governor, he said, you're out of here, you know? So he was an equal opportunity employer.
Well, thanks again to Diane Dinesh, former Lieutenant Governor, Martha Burke, author and podcast host, and Steve Terrell, the legendary reporter at the Santa Fe, New Mexico, now retired. Thank you all.
Thank you to Russell Contreras for moderating that discussion and to our guests for making time to come on the show. Right now on the New Mexico in Focus YouTube page, you can watch a special segment where each of our guests share some of their favorite anecdotes from their time working with, and in Steve's case, covering Bill Richardson. Just search for New Mexico in Focus on YouTube to find the page and that video. Now to a ballot proposal Santa Fe voters will consider in November. If passed, the so-called mansion tax would place a 3% excise tax on the purchase of new homes valued at $1 million or more. It would only apply to each dollar over a million. The revenue would go directly into the city's Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Santa Fe City Councilors approved the measure for the November ballot by an 8-to-1 vote last month, the goal being to tighten the housing disparity in a city with a median home price hovering around $650,000, according to most estimates. This week, I caught up with Mike Lofton, the CEO of HomeWise, a nonprofit home builder focused on affordable housing. Lofton contends Santa Fe's housing market is in a dire situation, and this proposal could bring some balance.
Mike Lofton, thanks for joining me on New Mexico in Focus.
Glad to be here.
Now, we'll get into that ballot measure on the table for Santa Fe voters in just a second, but I want to start with the broader housing situation in the capital city right now. How would you describe the housing market there?
Well, I've been working on housing issues in Santa Fe for 31 years now. It's the worst I've ever seen it. It's like the median price is over, you know, $660, I think, now. Okay. Yeah, we haven't seen that before. There's very few new homes being built that are entry-level homes that a first-time home buyer can afford. So yeah, it's gotten tough.
What conditions have allowed the city to reach that point?
Well, I think Santa Fe's always had a lot of pressure on its housing market because it's a very, you know, people love Santa Fe. And so lots of people who are buying million-dollar homes generally didn't make their money here. In New Mexico, they made it somewhere else, and you sell a house in California and have a lot of equity, you can buy a lot of house, oftentimes with cash. So there's always been that pressure. I think after the recession happened, the Great Recession, people just quit building new homes, so we have a huge undersupply. This is true for the whole country now. There's just this huge undersupply of housing right now, so that's compounded it. And then COVID was like, you know, the perfect storm, I guess, where people who wanted to bail out of LA or somewhere else and say, I want a different kind of lifestyle, I can telecommute, and I would have never guessed that, right, that a pandemic would cause housing inflation, not the opposite. I thought everything would just grind to a halt. It was the complete opposite. So places like New Mexico, it put a lot of pressure on the housing market.
So who is getting priced out right now in the current scenario?
Well, it's people who work there, right? So, you know, school teachers, nurses, police officers, you know, well over a third of Santa Fe's workforce lives outside the county, not just, you know, outside the city limits, but in a different county. And we need people to teach our kids, and we need nurses, and we need people to work at restaurants, and people that buy expensive second homes want somebody to wait their table too. So it's good for everybody if people can live where they work.
Has there been any recent progress in trying to create more affordable housing?
There has, and there's been, you know, and the city has actually done a lot of good things, right? I mean, they have this Affordable Housing Trust Fund, which was, I think, the first in the state. To dedicate local money for affordable housing, so that was a big deal. They a long time ago bought Tierra Contenta, which is a big piece of land on the south end of Santa Fe where a lot of new affordable housing has been built. So they've been pretty, you know, they prioritize other federal money for affordable housing, so, they're doing a lot. It's just not enough to deal with the problem that we have.
So this proposal that voters are going to consider in November, it would place a 3% excise tax on the purchase price of homes in the city over $1 million. So that's every dollar over the 1 million point would be taxed. If voters pass this, and an estimated $4.5 million would go into that affordable housing trust fund that you just mentioned, can you explain how that trust fund works?
Well, the trust fund's been around for quite a while, and originally it was funded by, you know, land sales that the city had, or, you know, just this kind of one-off episodic events, right, to put some money into it. More recently, the leadership of the city has been good at putting at least $3 million of general fund revenue into it every year. So that's been good. That's relatively new. That's only happened in the last few years. Now this is going to bring in, like, if they do this excise tax on the value of a home above $1 million, it's $4.5 to probably $6 million. Okay. Will come in every year. So that's significant, right? It's not going to solve the whole problem. It's like, you know, we have this whole perfect is the enemy of the good argument going on. Well, it won't solve everything. Well, I don't know anything that solves everything, but it's going to. But it's a step in the right direction. It's going to do a lot. So if a local government doesn't have its own money to invest in housing, it's almost impossible to leverage other people's money, private money, federal money. You have to have money in the game you have to have an ante in order to play the game. So the fact that they have local money, the beauty of the trust fund is it's super flexible. So we use it, HomeWise uses it to build new homes, entry-level homes, Habitat for Humanity does the same thing. But also, like, you know, somebody who is a victim of domestic violence can get a rent voucher through the program to make sure they have safe housing. So way better to get somebody into a safe place to live than have them live in a car for 3 months, right? So the flexibility of it allows us to address multiple aspects of the affordable housing problem.
So $3 million right now from the general fund, potentially $4.5 to $6 million. So that's more than double would be added to it. Is that enough money to make an impact?
It makes an impact. I mean, it won't solve the whole problem. We still got to build new homes. We still need to have, and they're working on changing the land use code to make some of that easier. But you got to do multiple things. Like, you know, complex problems have multiple causes, and you have to have multiple aspects of the solution. So I think it'll be a big deal to have that kind of money, available.
Now, in 2009, Santa Fe voters rejected a similar measure. It would have applied to homes above $750,000, and it would have applied a tax rate of 1% instead of the 3% that we're seeing right now. That did not pass. What's different now? Do you think it has a better shot?
I think it has a way better shot. And I think, you know, that first time I was around when that was going on, and basically the business community kind of reflexively came out against any kind of new tax, because we don't like that T word, right? This time, the only ones coming out against is the Association of Realtors, which is no surprise, because I think the broader business community realizes if we don't have housing that our workforce can afford, I mean, they're struggling just to keep their doors open. I mean, healthcare has all these vacancies, private businesses have all these vacancies. There's the restaurants that are closing down 2 to 3 days a week because they can't get enough of a workforce. I think people realize, no, we really have to make it possible for the workforce to live there, or it's going to affect everybody negatively. So I think and the problem's gotten so much worse than it was back then in 2009. So I think there's a recognition we really need to do something, and we need to do it now.
How would you respond to that criticism in general? And is there any other organized opposition other than the Santa Fe Association of Realtors?
I think the realtors just have it wrong. I don't think most realtors, I mean, I know more realtors are for this than against it. But I also know realtors who work more with first-time home buyers and that end of the market, not, million-dollar second homes. But if you think your industry in real estate is the main part of that and the most important part of that are people buying second homes, very expensive second homes, I get the concern, I get the fear. But if you look at the housing market as a whole, look, it's first-time home buyers, and those first-time home buyers eventually get enough equity and their families grow and they buy a bigger home. So having mobility within the housing market is really important. Having a healthy housing spectrum is important. I actually think this is going to be good for the real estate industry because it's going to flush out the market. It's so focused right now on selling second homes to, multi-million dollar homes to people buying a second home. Those folks aren't, they're only here part of the time. They're not fueling gross receipts tax. They're not paying those taxes if you're only here two weeks out of the year. So this tax makes a lot of sense to me that part of the market that's very skewed upward is that we use that to help fuel and make healthy the rest of the housing market, which I think is going to be good for everybody.
The city said that it hopes projects like the Santa Fe Suites could be a model for more affordable housing developments, but the most recent attempt, the Lamplighter project, it's still facing delays. Given the disparities in access to housing up in Santa Fe, why do things seem to move so slowly?
Well, that's a really good question. And they do move way too slowly. And I think we got to get it out of our own way. I think so. You have to have money to do these projects. The Santa Fe Suites wouldn't have happened, and Lamplighter would not have happened without money coming into it, including money from the Affordable Housing Trust Fund. Now, that doesn't mean we shouldn't also be working to improve the development review process and make it more efficient and quicker. We want to make good decisions. We want to make sure there's a building code that protects people's in place. But I think we can do a better job of making the machinery of government work more efficiently, for sure.
Is there anything else that stands in the way? You've been publicly critical of a not in my backyard type of attitude up there. How does that translate into roadblocks when trying to build these developments?
Well, everybody says, I'm for affordable housing. Everybody says I'm for reducing our carbon footprint and addressing climate change. And then we have a solar farm outside of Santa Fe that people are opposing because it's in their backyard, right? So, I think this just goes with it. It is going to affect those folks. They're going to see solar panels and not what they see now. Same with affordable housing, that you're not going to have the same view, or you can't take your dog there to use the bathroom on that vacant lot. But if we are going to address what we need as a whole community, we have to make those trade-offs and stuff. And it's way better to build affordable housing and infill lots using existing infrastructure and not fueling sprawl, where now people have to drive farther to get to work, which is not good for their families and it's not good for the environment. So yeah, we need to have the political will to do this. Part of it is, do we have money? Are we funding stuff? Part of it, are we approving things that the people of Santa Fe need?
Do you think that is being communicated effectively to the public, you know, the need for maybe sacrificing a little bit for the greater long-term good of the city?
You know, I think the problem is that a lot of political debate and a lot of public discourse is just that it's this pro and con. It's just, it's kind of this knee-jerk reaction to stuff, as opposed to sitting down and saying, okay, well, what kind of community do we really want to live in? What do we want our future to be? And so at HOMOS, we have this whole livability series where we're bringing people from speakers into Santa Fe to talk. Let's talk about the big picture. So we're having one on water. We're doing one on parking, and there's just this story that a third of downtown Albuquerque's landmass is dedicated to parking. It's like, is that really what we want, or would we like a more walkable downtown? would we like to be able to work downtown and walk to lunch and go for a drink after work? And like, people go on vacation, they go to European cities to have that experience. Why don't we do that here? Why don't we do some of the stuff that we love? But I think people are afraid of change, right? And then once you, because there might be some kind of loss there. Oftentimes, once that change happens, people embrace it. It's like, what was I thinking? It's great to be able to walk down the street and get a cup of coffee, whereas one that was proposed is like, oh, that's only going to increase traffic. It's always some kind of loss. And we know this. Psychologists study this, right? I mean, we fear loss way more than we relish gain. And we need to, as a community, there's a huge gain from having your workforce be able to live in the community. When there's an emergency, the SWAT team police officer doesn't have to commute 60 minutes from Albuquerque to Santa Fe. It's a good thing to have them in our neighborhood. So let's do it.
Now, essentially, this proposal that's on the table, these are my words, but it's the tax the rich philosophy in general. But whatever the dollar amounts, could something like this translate to another city in New Mexico, say Albuquerque?
I think so, because I think the thing is, what you're looking at is, housing is part of a marketplace, right? And so what you have in Santa Fe is this very skewed upward market, and people at the entry level of that market are being left out. So, there's been an argument, why don't we just, raise the property taxes on everyone? Well, then now you're raising the housing cost, the property tax part of the housing cost, of the people who can least afford it. It makes sense to tax the second home, the more expensive home, to equalize that out. So I think it just makes a lot of sense to do that. Now, Albuquerque might be different, what that solution is. And I don't know that high-end end of the market in Albuquerque. But it's certainly worth looking at. And, and we should, in Santa Fe, it's a very appropriate, measured solution. But we should, but it's not going to be the only kind of solution. We need to be looking at different solutions in different places.
Overall in Santa Fe, is money enough to solve the larger problem of the housing disparities there? Are there other factors that make Santa Fe unaffordable for people?
No, money's not enough. I mean, you have to have money. That's part of the equation. But you also have to have new supply of housing. So just having money for down payment assistance, if you're not building some new homes, isn't going to solve the problem. So we need to do both, because if you're trying to help somebody get into a home, it's can they afford it and can they access it, right? If people don't have any access to down payment because the rents are so high they can't save it, we got to close that gap too. So you got to do multiple things. So I think the biggest thing Santa Fe needs to do, it's made a lot of progress on developing new rental housing, where we're falling behind. If you look at a graph, the number of rental permits is going up quite a bit. The number of permits for ownership housing has been going down over the last several years. So we got to shift that dynamic. But it's doable, and I think it's, it's not like this is a solvable problem, but you need the political will to solve it.
Mike Lofton, thanks for joining me here on New Mexico in Focus.
Great, thank you.
Thank you to Mike Lofton from the nonprofit home builder HomeWise for making time to speak with me this past week. Of course, today is September 11th, a day that we all should acknowledge here in the United States. Governor Michelle Lujan Grisham issued a statement this morning saying in part, quote, "Among those lost were mothers, fathers, sons, and daughters. One New Mexican, Retired Alamogordo Police Lieutenant Al Marchand was among them, leaving behind a wife and son. Americans will never forget the loss of so many lives, but we also never forget the highest forms of sacrifice and heroism we witnessed that day. End quote. The governor also joined the Albuquerque Fire Department this morning at their annual Memorial Stair Climb to honor the 343 firefighters who died on September 11th, 2001. Thank you all for listening to the podcast this week. Be sure to follow our pages on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and YouTube throughout the week. You can give us feedback or just stay up to date as we post previews and news items leading up to our show on Friday night. Thanks again, everyone. I'm Senior Producer Lou DeVizio for Monday, September 11th, 2023. This is New Mexico in Focus, the podcast. Have a great week, everyone.